you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the Policy and Implementation Working Group call on the 6th of August, 2014. On the call today, we have Jonathan Frost, Klaus Stoll, Cheryl Langdon Orr, Avery Doria, Amr Elstar, Greg Shadden, J. Scott Evans, Olivi Kuami, and Chuck Gomes. We have apologies from Michael Graham. From staff, we have Marika Konings, Mary Wong, Amy Bivens, Steve Chan, and myself, Terry Agnew. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and please begin.
Thank you. This is J. Scott for the record. I want to first thank everybody who attended the call last week and did such good work with Chuck. There was some robust discussions that went on. I listened to the recording yesterday afternoon and was pleased to hear. I do want to say that I was a little surprised by the overwhelming feeling that that all of these processes need to be tied to voting thresholds. My initial thought was, and when we looked at our tree, that I thought maybe one of the points of doing this was, you know, it would be outcome determinative, and depending on what outcome you were seeking, that would be the process that went through, and not every process would necessarily be tied to a voting threshold, because in certain instances, it's just that it wasn't, you know, putting any new obligations on any parties. It was just seeking some sort of input. And I know Cheryl and Michael Graham, I know for sure, and I think maybe even Greg spoke up with regards to the desire to have voting thresholds. And so, I just wonder if maybe I see Cheryl saying yes, that in fact is the case. If we sort of want to go back to thinking about these things being outcome determinative, and it may be that some of them, such as the PG as in group or guidance policy, require voting thresholds, but in others they don't. And I wanted to explore that a little bit. If you could see instances where voting thresholds weren't necessarily required, and if we've taken that into account here, or if everyone still is pretty much convinced that those type of voting thresholds are required. And so I'll take a cue on that question. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I already provided as well some input on this topic on the list, and just wanted to maybe emphasize some of the points I tried to convey in that, because indeed when developing and drafting this process, we had a close look at some of the existing mechanisms that the council has used for providing input, because again, we're looking here at a very lightweight input process where I think the examples that we looked at is input to the WHOIS review team, input to the ATRT2, where we're not looking on binding another party on doing something, but it's merely providing input. And those are often time sensitive. There's a certain deadline by which input needs to be provided. It often relies on a couple of people coming together and doing that. So the worry is that if we put in voting thresholds here, it means that there will need to be a motion. A motion needs to be submitted in a certain amount of time before a meeting. So that adds a motion can also be deferred, so you already are a month later. So it adds a lot of bureaucracy to something where I think what we try to translate is a kind of existing mechanism where it's a kind of, let's get together, write up a response. Do people feel comfortable with it? Yes? Okay, let's send it. If not, do we do a bit more work? Can we come up with something? Or if we really don't agree, well, then we don't send anything and we leave it to our respective groups to do so. And I think that has worked quite effective in the past. So the concern is from my perspective, is if we add too much bureaucracy here, is that this will be a very beautiful process, but it will never, ever get used because, the council will just refer back to those ad hoc processes that will allow it to, do it in a time-sensitive manner. And one thing I noted as well in listening to the call is that some people seem concerned that, by not having voting thresholds, it would mean that, you know, council members would just go off in the wild and just do whatever they thought was good without, you know, needing to check back. But I think there's, you know, council members are there as representatives of their stakeholder groups and constituencies, and at least from our experience to date, I think many of them, or most of them, are really good at going and checking back and also notifying the council if they believe additional time is needed or further consultations are needed on certain topics before taking a decision. So, and there's also, of course, in this process, there's always at the end of the day as well, at the moment when decisions are taken, also the always the option to say, look, we don't agree. Let's, you know, pull this back. So there's also, during that time frame, of course, opportunities for consultations and input. So as, you know, I think I expressed in my email, I, you know, for this specific process, if we really want to keep it lightweight and, you know, easy way for council to provide input to certain, you know, requests or issues that it sees open for consultation, I would strongly suggest that you consider that this, you know, is done without a vote, but maybe through a non-objection or a support from the different council members to at least start exploring the issue, noting that, of course, at the end of this process, there's always still the opportunity to object to the outcomes or agree that nothing should be sent at all.
Okay. So, Marika, that would be in the instance where it's not putting any new obligations on anyone. It's basically just providing input.
Yeah, and this is Marika, because I see some questions in the chat. This is specifically to the policy input process. I think, as I tried to point out, and Jay Scott already referred to as well, I think most, you know, the processes that are up for discussion here are, I think we really would like people to focus on the outcome. So the whole idea would be that when the council has an issue it needs to deal with, it basically considers what is the desired outcome that we want. Is the desired outcome that, you know, the board has to consider this and take it on unless, you know, it overturns it with, you know, supermajority votes if it's not in the interest of ICANN or you know, security and stability issues? Or is, you know, the desired outcome to provide input as part of other inputs to a certain consultation or a mechanism? And for that second one, you know, the policy input process, you're saying that's a kind of lightweight process. At the end of the day, it's not, you know, the council is not obligating anyone to do anything or creating new obligations. It's just input that is provided for that. So for that, you may not want to have, you know, voting threshold motions that add more bureaucracy to it. However, for that other process where you would create certain obligations on another party, in this case the board, to actually, you know, consider it and possibly even take it on, you may want to have indeed this kind of, you know, voting threshold and this process in place so that it has, you know, a true multi-stakeholder process going forward and then certain checks and balances in place. So just to clarify, so indeed the policy input process, our suggestion would be to not have a voting threshold to kick that off. But for the policy guidance process, I think that was also discussed at the last meeting, suggestion would be to maybe follow the same voting threshold as for initiating a PDP. Well, you could also maybe consider simple majority. And then one other suggestion we made, and I think that we're coming back to that later, is that if you would want to consider the policy guidance process as a potential alternative or a potential fast-track PDP, you could consider having a supermajority vote for initiating it, as that would, you know, kind of guarantee that, you know, everyone at least in the council or most on the council are on board with using a fast-track approach to developing potential consensus policy.
Okay. Thanks, Marika. Chuck?
Thanks, Jay Scott, and thanks, Marika. One of the concerns is that the sorry about the doorbell that you're probably hearing. Is that, for example, a communication from the GNSO Council to the board, they will automatically assume, unless it's made very clear otherwise, that that's a position of the GNSO, not just the GNSO Council. So I think at a minimum, if the council acts quickly on something like that, and I respect the need for that in some situations, I think there needs to be a requirement that any communication that goes forward clearly says that this wasn't done through a bottom-up process, unless that bottom-up work it had already been done. so that there's not any generalizations made that, oh, the whole GNSL supports this, for example, on a strategic plan comment. If it's just from the council or just from a simple majority of the council or some subset of the council, that needs to be made clear, and I think that's okay as long as it's made clear.
Okay. Alan?
Thank you. I'm not disagreeing with Chuck, but I have a problem. I understand the GNSO is not the same as the GNSO Council, but the GNSO Council is the only voice with which the GNSO can speak as a unit. And certainly if something gets approved by a bare majority of the GNSO Council, it shouldn't be treated as a GNSO position if it has some onerous, you know, import or meaning to it. On the other hand, if something is approved, let's say, with a supermajority, then de facto it is a GNSO position. It was passed by the GNSO Council, but it's a GNSO position, and perhaps as a caveat, but the registry stakeholder group clearly disagreed or something like that. You know, the council is the only voice we have from the GNSO to speak as an entity. So I'm worried that we would say something the GNSO council does is not a position of the GNSO. Obviously, you have to weigh what threshold was used to get it approved. But within that level of detail, I think they are the same. They become the same because there's no other way to get a GNSO position. Thank you.
Okay. So I see Aubrey's been asking a lot of questions in the chat. And, you know, the way I understand a PIP, policy input, is not that one person wants it, it's that an external force is asking for input. And the default is that the GNSO Council would provide input. The question is, well, what? How do they do that? And should there be, you know, what if there's dissent as to that? And should there be voting thresholds that are required to move forward, or other than a, you know, a general agreement or a majority saying that they believe it needs to move forward. Marika, I'm sorry.
Yeah, this is Marika. And maybe just to give a few more examples of where I think that indeed the PIP would come in, or where, you know, maybe it doesn't, or as well to Avery's point. For example, we recently had discussion at the council level whether there should be any input provided as a GNSO council on the strategic plan. And that was something I think that has come back on several agenda items. And there actually we saw that no one really felt a real need to do anything. Some said it could be a good idea. I think others said, well, you know, we'd rather do that through our groups. And there actually, you know, nothing was kicked off. So I think it's kind of translating how, you know, it currently works, where I think on those issues, and indeed, sometimes it's when something is asked, but sometimes it's also the kind of proactive where, you know, someone picks up a certain report has been put out for public comment. Does the council as a whole want to provide input? And again, I think that into the conversation that the council has, indeed, do we want to do it? And as I put in the chat as well, maybe at the outset someone objects and says, well, no, I don't think that's the role for the council. And I think that has happened. And some may say, okay, well, if someone actually volunteers to put something together, I'll reserve my judgment until I'll see what you've actually written up to see if I and my group, you know, can live with that as a council response. So I think there are different ways in which this has already been done in practice. And I think what we've been just trying to do is actually just write that up as a kind of process, so it's more clear from the outset, you know, what that should in principle, you know, what are some of the minimum requirements such a process should ideally follow. But it still doesn't preclude the council taking other approaches or, you know, adding steps to it. As I said, you know, in certain cases, you may want to have public comment on something, or indeed add additional time for groups to provide input and do another round of drafting, redrafting. So I think, again, this is just a kind of, you know, minimum bare bones kind of process that it just makes it clear for external parties, you know, what this is. And again, what at the end of the day the desired or the expected outcome is, and you know, what the hope is that it will do, basically.
Okay. All right. So, Greg.
Hi, Greg Shatton for the record. I guess my concern here is I agree with Alan in his statement that, you know, the GNSO Council is essentially the mouthpiece of the GNSO, or at least the organization that approves statements that emanate from the GNSO, you know, just as, you know, PDP, you know, working group reports, you know, come from the working group but end up, you know, must be approved by the council. Everything, you know, ultimately gets filtered through the council, and the council is seen as the speaking organ of the GNSO. So I think it's important that we do understand at the end of each decision-making process how is a decision approved or not approved, and what kind of vote will be taken by the council in order to approve it, and earlier, you know, during the process, you know, will there be a consensus taken? You know, we have this interesting system, you know, where the working groups and other kind of subsidiary groups, you know, work by consensus, but the council itself does not. You know, I think that it's still appropriate when dealing with matters of policy that the actual, you know, decision on policy be taken by consensus, and the ratification or affirmation of it be taken by the council on the, you know, council basis, which would, you know, presumably be, unless we made it otherwise, the voting threshold specified in the operating procedures, you know, which is a, you know, over 50% of each house. And with regard to timeliness, I would note in my role as a representative to the SCI that we are, you know, continue to work on ways to make the GNSO Council, you know, more nimble in that regard, you know, at the request of the council, with things like, you know, voting outside a meeting by electronic or other means, and ways to waive the 10-day motion deadline. So that, you know, clearly timeliness and nimbleness are critically important, but getting a decision right and not having, you know, groups be kind of steamrolled by bare majorities or, you know, lack of a consensus process is equally, if not more, important. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. Listening to Greg's point, it really seems to me that the crux, at least on the policy input process, is really on the adoption of the recommendation and how that actually works. So maybe that is something where, you know, we need to think of what potential different scenarios are, whether indeed that is a, you know, non-objection vote or a simple majority vote, or indeed if it is a simple majority vote, how is it then reflected, you know, who has voted in favor, who has it voted against, or, you know, is this as well on the policy input process, is that something that needs to be adopted by non-objection, basically? If there's one person objecting, is that enough to say, well, this cannot be communicated as, you know, a GNSO council position? So maybe that, instead of, you know, actually focusing, I think, on the starting that process, you know, maybe that is actually the part where there's some further thought or conversation may need to go into. What does it actually mean to have indeed input adopted by the council? Is it still input if it's a, you know, only half plus one submitted? Is it still the voice of the GNSO council? And I know that is one, and I think we reviewed that as well. I think that was, for example, the case, I think, in comments that were provided, and I think it was the WHO's review team report, I'm not exactly sure, but where indeed we did have a kind of vote and where it was kind of reflected, or no, maybe it was the TMCH, sorry. I think it was another one. I think the TMCH input provided, where there was indeed disagreement and no unanimous support for the response. And even though it was called out in, I think, in the letter that was sent, I think still people felt quite uncomfortable how about how that actually came about, and is that still useful to provide that input if it's not the consensus kind of position. So again, coming back, I think maybe that's where actually the focus of the conversation should be, and also coming out, maybe moving some of this forward. As I suggested as well, I think in the email I sent, maybe on some of this, as this is this is at the kind of high level, but the idea is that we would translate this into a kind of similar to the PDP manual in a PIP manual that basically provides more detail around these different steps. And maybe that is something where staff can maybe work on a first draft and possibly outline some options that the group could consider to see where people feel more comfortable with. Indeed, is this a non-objection vote? Is it a simple majority, supermajority, unanimous? So maybe that is something there where we could provide a couple of options and then have some further conversation about what people think would make the most sense in this context.
Yeah, this is Jay Scott. Thanks, Marieke. My only concern is that I don't want any one group within the GNSO Council to be able to derail the GNSO giving input. I think that, especially in what I, in my experience, would say, deals with very contentious issues. And I think if, the GNSO Council is made up of X number of constituencies, and if all but one of those constituencies thinks that this input is solid input needs to be given, I think it should go forward. Now, that doesn't mean to say that the other voice should be silenced. I certainly think that they should be able to voice their dissension as often as vociferously as they wish to. But I think it's important that we not set up any system where one particular group has some sort of super veto power, because if we do that, I think it's going to be very difficult to ever give any input at all. I think I see Alan's hand up.
Thank you. You're certainly right, and when we crafted the current voting thresholds, when the bicameral GNSO Council was created, they were set up very carefully to make sure that no single stakeholder group could veto. Now, to pass something with a supermajority without anyone having the ability to veto, there's got to be an awful strong support from the rest of the council other than that stakeholder group. But that is how it's defined right now, and that was done quite deliberately. The supermajority is the measure which allows the council to make a decision but not be vetoable, if that's a word. Thank you. And that assumes, of course, that each stakeholder group is in theory completely independent. And, of course, vertical integration has changed that significantly. And sometime in the future, it may be more difficult to distinguish between the registries and registrars, at which point the combined group does have a veto. So that's something we may want to think about in the future. Thank you.
Okay. I think Chuck is next.
Thanks. And Alan, you're right. The ability for one group to veto was carefully considered when looking at the thresholds. But it seems to me that we're assuming that if the council is asked for input, that the council should give input. And I don't think that's an accurate assumption. I think it's good if the council can communicate something that has strong support from its various entities. But there will be many cases when there will not be strong enough support across the constituencies and stakeholder groups and liaisons to actually do that. So I don't think it's right to assume that the council should always provide input. In some cases, the right answer is to defer it to the individual stakeholder groups and constituencies to provide input.
Okay, thanks, Chuck. Aubrey?
Hi. Yeah, this is Aubrey. Can I be heard, first of all? First time,
yes.
I've spoken. Oh, great. So, anyhow, in terms of kicking off these PIPs, I do have qualms. I actually think, though, it's probably fine to kick one off as long as there isn't objection. But if there is even a single objection, then there probably needs to be a vote to kick it off. I think in terms of it giving advice, first of all, I do think counsel gives advice, and that advice is representative of the GNSO. But in order for that to be the case, you have to hit the supermajority. So, and even without that, meaning that it can't be blocked. So I think it's reasonable to be able to kick off a PIP easily. Oh, I like that, kick off a PIP easily. But it should require a supermajority to actually pass it on as advice, and rely on the fact that all of those voting in that supermajority are indeed representing their SGs and Cs in the manner that those SGs and Cs determine according to their charters. For example, some have directed votes, and some have will beat you up if you vote wrong proposals. But that's up to the that's up to the SGC. So perhaps that combination, easy start, but still a threshold for passing on, is something to consider. Thanks.
Okay. How about, Aubrey, this is Jay Scott, how about only having a vote to pass on if there's objection? Are you there, Aubrey?
Yeah, I thought I was here.
Now
I'm here. Okay. I think that certainly, but that is tantamount to a vote. If the chair says, are there any objections, and he's got a full quorum, at the meeting, et cetera, that's close. But then again, that's not quite a supermajority, so that needs to be looked at more carefully. In general, I think that, if the full council is sitting and the chair says, okay, do we need to do a vote, or are there no objections, that's tantamount to full unanimity. And of course, that beats a supermajority anytime.
Okay. Alan?
I just wanted to note that's very similar to the rules at ALAC uses. The ALAC attempts to make things by consensus, and consensus is an informal definition, but it's sort of 85%. You're allowed a few dissents, but not many. If a decision cannot be made by consensus, then it goes back to a vote, and typically a majority vote, unless it's some special kind of decision. So what we're talking about is very similar to what's being used at the moment in the ALAC.
So what I'm hearing, this is Jay Scott for the record, is that the issue of what type of voting would be required and when it would be required needs to be carefully considered. But that's really not where we are at this point. What we are at this point is we're looking at these processes to make sure that sort of the track works, and then once that's been established and we then decide to draft guidelines to sort of flush out these higher level concepts, that we need to consider the voting issue. Would that be and carefully consider it, and where it would take place? What stage in the process, when I say where it would take place? Is that an accurate representation of sort of our discussion to this point? I'm looking for our votes, for those of you that are in the Connect room, if you could let me know. Aubrey, is that a new hand or an old hand?
It's a new one, but I did put a check up there for a second to say I agreed with your characterization. I just wanted to sort of park the issue for later of no objection equaling or being the equivalent of a supermajority vote, in that we don't, I haven't checked the counts for quorum, so you could have a bare quorum that is unanimous, but that still isn't numerically equal to supermajority. So I just want to put that caveat in the parking space, because I had sort of said, yeah, okay, if no one objects, but
yeah.
But that's really got a quorum dependency, so I just wanted to mark that.
Okay, so that, Alan?
Yeah, just one other note, talking about the ALAC rules, we also have a rider saying if anyone requests a vote will be taken.
Okay. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika, and I think the security mechanism is still at the end of the day that, you know, if there's a supermajority vote to adopt recommendations, even if, you know, someone wanted to object to the process even starting, I think there's still, you know, a safety valve there that, you know, sufficient votes are even required to actually pass it on. So I think there's a two-step approach there that hopefully that will alleviate any concerns that, you know, there is some the quorum rule, but I think we've been, you know, quite good as well with proxies and having issues on time on the agenda. So hopefully that wouldn't be any kind of situation where people don't feel that they had actually a chance to speak up. But if they still feel that was the case, there is still that, you know, if we indeed do decide that there should be majority vote, supermajority vote to actually pass on the input to board or whatever group the input is directed to, that there's still then that opportunity for a group to say, look, this, you know, we didn't agree with this in the first place to start, and we definitely don't support providing your recommendations. Chuck is saying if a vote is requested, does it require a motion? Yes, that is my understanding. If we're voting on something, and that typically the way the council votes is on through motions, so that would require a motion. So that would indeed mean additional time as well.
All right. So looking at the charts we have in front of us, are we sort of comfortable with this outline of how this would flow? You have the two different processes here that we've added, the policy guidance process and the policy input process. Is everybody comfortable with sort of that broad outline? And what the parameters for qualifying for one or the other processes are? Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I don't know if we're also still going to come back specifically to the policy guidance process. I think there were some specific questions that, you know, weren't completely addressed, I think, at the last meeting. And one of those relates, I think, to requirements on the board in relation to, you know, at the end of the day, if the whole PGP has been followed, you know, supermajority vote has taken place, what are the requirements that are posed upon the board in relation to considering those recommendations? Does that follow the identical process as for the PDP, where, you know, there is a mechanism for the board to overturn recommendations if they meet a certain voting threshold, and if it's, you know, they need to explain that it's in not in the interest of ICANN or may have certain security or stability issues, but there is a mechanism again as well to go back and have, you know, a dialogue and have a supplementary recommendation. So is that the similar kind of process that people would like to see here, or should we think of something else, as this is a, you know, in a certain way a more lightweight mechanism than a full PDP, and if so, what should that, you know, alternative mechanism be, or what kind of requirements would people like to see on the board? And then there's also the question or suggestion, I think, that I had made in some of my comments is, you know, people spoke about, you know, the need or considering a fast track PDP process for a certain set of limited circumstances. I think some of those that were identified were in the case where policy recommendations are implemented, but it's realized that a tweak needs to be made or it's having unintended consequences that need to be fixed in a more expedited manner, and for cases where there has been significant scoping already being done, either because, you know, a PDP was initiated or kicked off, but then not initiated at that stage, so there is already an issue report or a lot of information available. And one of the suggestions was that maybe a PGP could serve that function, and, you know, having the kind of safety valve there at the start to really make sure that everyone is comfortable that this can be done through a kind of fast-track process where you basically, you know, eliminate the first part of a PDP would be to, you know, have a PGP with supermajority, which could possibly be a fast track PDP. So I think that was one of the suggestions that that we had made, and interested to see what people's feedback is on that.
Okay, it looks like Almer and Cheryl are agreeing with that. I saw that Almer has his hand up.
Well, thanks, J. Scott. This is Almer. Yeah, I completely agree with what Marika just said. I do find, according to the flow chart, and I apologize if you've gone over this already because I haven't been on a working group call for quite some time now, but it seems to me that the requirement to initiate a policy guidance process here is very similar to a sort of a set of a policy or a framework that already exists when you require clarification, input, or advice on existing policy recommendations, which is reconvening the PDP working group that already recommended these policies to the GNSO Council, and then following that to the ICANN board so that it's ICANN policy. So I'm not seeing, according to this flowchart, I'm not seeing what is new, what the added value of the policy guidance process is, unless the box in the middle is somehow changed, which means that policy guidance process would address a different need, similar to the ones that Marika just described. Thanks.
Thanks, Omer. Alan?
Thank you. Couple of things. In terms of whether the output of the PIP is binding upon the board, I think you have to do something like that. If something's passed by a GNSO, by a supermajority of the GNSO, I think you have to make it onerous for the board to reject it. So I think there needs to be a similar rule to what there is in a PDP. Now, I also think we need clarity for what does the board have to do or is obliged to do if it is only passed with a majority. We currently have the situation of a PDP being passed by a majority but not a supermajority, and it's still a little bit fuzzy as to, clearly in most people's minds that cannot set capital C, capital P consensus policy, but outside of that it's not clear to what extent the board has the ability to reject it what happens with it if it only has a majority. Something that struck me as we were talking in the last couple of minutes, that it takes a very low very low threshold to initiate a PDP. Now, and I was wondering to myself, should we have a similarly low threshold? But the difference is, if a PDP goes all the way through, it does have a strong position coming out of a working group, which is a bottom-up process on any results. So it's, I don't think we could get away on the lighter weight processes of having the lower threshold. I think we do need at least the majority to go ahead on those. And lastly, in terms of other processes that we have, I suspect we still do need the equivalent of a lightweight PDP, but I would really like to consider the concept of reopening a PDP to fix problems or to address something which hadn't been addressed, which the group did not think it needed to address. It's already things that are already within the scope of the issue report, and I think that will solve the majority of the problems that we have in terms of tweaking the PDP output based on, you know, what we see in terms of real experience, or addressing something which we can't fix now, but we think a year from now the world may be different, or 2 years from now. So I really would like to make sure that stays on the table. Thank you.
Okay. This is Jay Scott. Marika?
This is Marika. I just wanted to ask a clarifying question of Anna, because I think he was referring to a majority vote to initiate the PGP. But I think currently we had been suggesting that maybe it's the same as initiating a PDP, which is lower than the simple majority. So I just wanted to check whether, which one he meant. And also asking, because I think in principle that I think that is what is envisioned with the policy guidance process, reopening the PDP. Because basically the idea is that, if the council decides indeed to invoke it as a fast-track PDP, the idea would be that they would, you know, define what the scope is and decide how that will be done. And that could mean, indeed, I think as currently as well under some of the other provisions, like, you know, reconvening the original PDP working group if they're still around. However, if, you know, this may be a couple of years later for some reason, you know, for the implementation too long or whatever, and, you know, everyone may have disappeared, they may also need to reconstitute a group or a new group, or depending on what the specific issue is, it may require different expertise or information. But I think that's at least, you know, from our perspective, what would be envisioned, that this is the kind of way where you identify the specific issue that you want to fix, you note all the previous information that is already available, you either reconvene the PDP working group that did your original recommendations if that is still viable, or you, you know, form some kind of other group that is tasked to actually do it. But some of the steps are so similar where you do need to go out to all the stakeholder groups, constituencies, SOAC, to ask for input, make sure that anything that comes up is as well put up for public comment, and you know, some of the other steps that I think we do consider as kind of minimal requirements on making sure that is a multi-stakeholder, bottom-up process, so that at the end of the day we can say that, you know, this is really the view of the community that we, you know, bring to the board, basically.
Thank you, Marika. Aubrey?
Yeah. I tend to agree with, I think, part of what I understood Alan to be saying, in that, because traditionally I've been against the option of a fast-track PDP, but I think if we're looking at a PDP that is based on work done in a previous PDP, and therefore there's, as Marika was saying, lots of work done already, there's already a final report, there may have even been decisions and implementations, that could be an area where a faster track would be reasonable. Now, I would bang away from the notion of reconstituting a PDP. I think, because if it's anything other than this, you know, strange situation we're in now where the recommendations have not been accepted yet, which is a case of its own, but in general, assuming that the PDP has completed its full process, then it really should be started anew, even though it's fast-tracked and it builds upon, you know, so you wouldn't necessarily do an issues report again unless that was specifically asked for, you know, and you would have the final from the other, so you'd be able to just jump right into it. But I think that we confuse the issue when we start talking about reconstituting versus not reconstituting. So I would avoid that, but I think that if we were to restrict the PGP, and I have to confess every time I say that I think of pretty good privacy, but if we have a PGP and if we restricted it to something that was already sort of a new, it has to be a substantive new issue on an already, or substantive new evidence on something that already had been PDP'd. Thanks.
Thank you. Alan?
Yeah, thank you. Just to address Chuck's question, you just put in the chat, the difference with the IGO-INGO one is we are reconvening, or whatever the word is, the PDP working group on issues the board has not yet voted on. And that's a substantive difference. What I was referring to when I was talking about the concept of restarting a PDP, and I like restart rather reconvene, because chances are it is 2 years later, and, you know, we're not going to try to put the same group together. The concept of restarting the PDP, I think, we may just be in a nomenclature problem, is because to create a consensus policy, it has to be a PDP right now, and I think that's a good base on which to stay. So the concept of restarting a PDP within the same overall scope as the original one, with whatever rules we come up with for that process, allows us to keep the rule that a consensus policy, capital C, capital P, can only be created by a PDP and has to, and is honored. And remember, that that has to do with words that are in contracts right now, so we can't easily, we can change the bylaws easily, but we can't easily change all the contracts. So that's why I was looking at the concept of restarting a PDP for the issues which are within the same scope. Thank you. Marika also asked the question when I was talking about would I accept that I thought it needed a 50% threshold. I haven't really looked at the PGP right now, so maybe the lower threshold is fine with that. If there's enough bottom-up work within the process, then yes, it would be acceptable. But I admit I haven't re-looked at that chart recently. Thank you.
Okay. So, thank you, Alan. This is Jay Scott. At this point, I want to move us on to talk about the next steps with regards to this deliverable. And I see here that we've got these charts that outline these two processes, the two new processes, the PGP and the PIP. And I want to put to the group that as we move on to our next deliverable, perhaps it might be worthy to have staff begin and provide us with a rough draft of a guideline for these processes that we could then look at, discuss, edit, and get into final form to be delivered with our recommendations. And I wanted to know if that was acceptable to this group if we proceeded in that fashion. Chuck.
Thanks, Jay Scott. A question I have is it the role of this working group to actually propose specific details for each of these new processes, or should we just recommend that they be developed and that they then be developed by working groups that the GNSO Council forms? That just like they did with the PDP process.
Okay. Alan?
I was one of the ones who, when we started, was pretty vociferous that this group not develop detailed operating practices, but just come up with an overview. I'm not sure I'm agreeing. I'm not sure I still have that opinion. We're a lot farther along than I thought we ever would be, and we may be close enough that we could come up with detailed rules. I'm not 100% sure. But Marika has her hand up.
Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I think the charter definitely doesn't do that because it specifically asks for a set of recommendations on a process for developing GTD policy. And to me, a process means that you actually indeed map out what that means, and even, you know, the more guidance you can provide, the better. So I definitely wouldn't see it as, you know, going against the charter of providing that actual process and how it should look. And you know, personally, I think it would be a real pity after all the discussions and hard work that has been going on here that we would leave that and, you know, hand it over to another group that would basically have to reinvent again, I think, what we already did a lot of work on. Of course, it doesn't, you know, take away that whatever we come up with, the council may still tell us, you know, someone else needs to go off and do some more work. But my hope is that they would actually really welcome, you know, the detail and the level of thought that has gone into this. And again, I think as well, partly, you know, the next step would be to really take this back as well to the broader community to actually see, are we on the right track? Because maybe based on that feedback, we may get some pushback or you know, new suggestions or ideas that we may need to incorporate or adjust. So, and hopefully there will be as well a checkpoint, I think, when we next present to the council to see if anyone, I think at least on the past meeting, no one pushed back and said, well, don't give us too much detail. We want someone else to go and work it out. So I think for now, hopefully on the safe track. But if people do have concerns about it, it may be worth, you know, having one of our council liaisons go back to the council and ask that specific question, or, as I said, you know, use it as part of the conversation in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Do we – well, I mean, that's going to put us back 6 weeks if we wait to get that answered in Los Angeles. My question is, do we need to put just this rough framework out for public comment to see if that's on the right track? And then if we get a buy-in to that, then move forward? Or, I mean, what do people think the best methodology is to proceed? Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. If I maybe can make a suggestion, I think one idea would be for everyone on the call today, and maybe also encourage other working group members to take it back to their respective groups and already say, look, this is the direction we're heading in. Do people like it, have major concerns, questions, you know, ideas? And maybe then we can really use LA, because I think, you know, having public comment now may not be as effective, because I think, you know, there's a lot of other things going on. We probably then already get into the deadline for, you know, publication for LA, so I'm not really sure how well that would work. But then based on the feedback we get maybe from the different groups, we can still do some tweaking and editing, but then really use the LA meeting to put this in front to the broader community and say, hey, this is where we are, you know, to date. And, of course, in the meantime, we can already start looking at some of the other deliverables while we gather input, you know, from the different groups on where we're at today, so we can, you know, still adjust as needed, but not, you know, hold back on all the other work that we still need to do in some of the other charter questions.
Okay. Thank you. Chuck?
I first of all, want to say I think Marika's idea is fine. I just think that we should have a common communication that we all send to our groups, so that we're all sending the same message if we do that.
Okay. Greg.
Greg Shatton. This may be a more of a detail point, and I apologize for derailing the conversation slightly, but in the PIP, where we talk about a simple majority being a vote of the GNSO Council, it looks to me from looking at the operating procedures that maybe I'm wrong about this, that nothing actually happens by a simple majority, but that rather it's a majority of both of each house. So I think we may want to clarify what that term means. As a simple majority could just mean, you know, more than half of the sitting members or those of a quorum or who are, you know, present at a particular point in voting. As Ivory points out, there's a quorum issue there. So it seems to me that at the least it should be a majority of each house that would make a decision on a PIP. Thanks.
Okay. All right. So how about we the chairs and the staff work together to put together a cover email that would use to send this to the various lists. And then next we'll go ahead and get that, and next week have that ready to go and get out. And then we'll move on to wrapping up the sub-questions with regards to deliverable one, and then start looking at the template for dealing with our next deliverable. Does that sound like a plan? I see Cheryl agrees, and Chuck and Amr. So why don't we do that then? It's 1 o'clock, and Alan and Aubrey. Yay! I don't know if that's a simple majority of consensus or a super majority. But I'll take it. So what I would suggest we do is we come up with that, we put it to the list, and our hope is by next week we have gotten that approved and gotten that communication out to the various groups. We will then next week wrap up our discussions on the deliverable ones, considering sub-questions EA, EB, and EC, and I would ask that everyone look at those between now and the next meeting, so we're prepared to talk, and then we'll introduce the template that the staff has put together for tackling our deliverable two. Does that sound like a plan? With that, I'm going to ask the operator to bring the call to a close, and we will adjourn, and I thank everyone for their kind participation today and their attendance, and thank you all very much.
Thanks, Jay Scott.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. That concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.